Chapter 2. An Ochre Wave. Be it one man or 1 million, the enemy of the Imperium must be treated the same and denied with all diligence. Pius Cowl, Imperial Commissar, from his public education leaflets. Dusk came early at the end of the first day. The darkening sky was stained darker still by the smoke plumes rising from the hive and its outer districts, and by the great ashen pall looming over the salt grasslands to the south. Thick, fire-swollen, black smoke boiled up from the mining district and the heavy industrial suburbs south of the Curtain Wall, and a murky brown flare of burning fuel rose from ruptured tanks and silos on the Haast docks to the north of the river. Other threads of white, grey, and mauve smoke rose from hundreds of smaller, individual fires. The bombardment continued, even though the shield had been raised. A vast, translucent umbrella of field energy extended out from the great shield pylon in the central district and unfurled itself in a dome that reached down to anchor substations inside the curtain wall. Thousands of shells and missiles burst against it every minute, dimpling the cloudy energy and making it ripple and wobble like green gelatin. From inside the shield, it looked as if the green sky was blossoming with fire. Observers on the southern wall, most of them soldiers of Vervan Primary, trained their scopes and magnoculars through the rising smoke and fires in the outer habs, and saw the distant grass horizon flickering with a wall of flame 70 kilometers wide. The grass smoke, ash-grey but streaked with black from individual infernos down below the skyline, tarnished the southern sky in the dying light. Bright, brief flashes underlit the horizon smoke, hinting at the fierce armor battle taking place just out of sight. No communications had been received from General Vegalane's armored column for 2 hours. Now that the shield was up to cover the main hive, the outer habs, the heavy industry sectors, and the mining district south of the wall were taking the worst of it. Unprotected, they were raked mercilessly by long-range artillery, siege mortars, and incendiary rockets. As the light faded, the southern out-hive suburb became a dark, mangled mass, busy with thousands of fires, drizzled by fresh rains of explosives. From the wall, it was possible to see the shock waves radiating from each major strike, gusting the existing fires. The population of the southern outer habs was in the order of 9 million, plus another 6 million workers who dwelt in the main hive but travelled out to work the industrial district and the mines. They had little shelter. Some hid in cellars or underground storage bays, and many died entombed in these places. Penetrator shells dug them out explosively, like rats, opening the makeshift shelters to the sky. Others were sealed forever under thousands of tons of collapsed masonry. There were a few deep-seated, hard-point shelters in the southern habs, reserved for suburban officials and minor area legislators. These shelters had been dug 90 years before, during the trade war, and few were in decent working order. One group of HAB officials spent 2 hours trying to find the correct rune code to let them into their assigned shelter, and they were incinerated by a rocket before they could get the vault door open. Another group, a few blocks north, found themselves fighting off a terrified mob that wanted to gain access to a shelter too. A VPHC officer leading the group opened fire with his handgun to drive the frantic citizens away while the ranking official, a mill boss with guild connections, opened the vault. They sealed themselves in, 23 rank-privileged citizens of authority level 3 or less, in a bunker emplacement designed to shelter 200. They all died of suffocation by the following dawn. The air systems, long in need of overhaul and regular maintenance, failed the moment they were switched on. By nightfall, millions of refugees were clogging the main arterial routes into the hive, bottled up at Sondar Gate, at the Haast West Road entry, and the Ore Works cargo route. They were even trying to gain access via the rail link tunnel at Vever Gate, but the terminal inside had been turned into an inferno in the first wave of bombing, and the gate was blocked. Others still, in desperate, slowly moving lines, many laden with possessions or injured family members, dared the spoil and the mudflats, and some made it in through the as-yet undamaged railhead at Crow Gate. The Hass West fort was still burning, and the top of it was cascading debris down both inside and outside the wall. However, the wall and the Hass Gate itself were still firm, and streams of refugees made it into the hive via the Hass Road under supervision of Vervan primary troopers manning the damaged emplacement. But access was still slow, and a column of people, 2 kilometres long and growing, tailed back from the Hass Gate into the dark, vulnerable to the ceaseless onslaught pummeling the outer Habs. Thousands died before they could pass into shelter, as shells landed in the thick queue. Just as many, perhaps 8,000 or 9,000, fled the traffic stream northwest and made progress into the river shores. The last kinking stretch of shield wall north of Hass West Fort, known as the Dock Wall, reached out into the mid-waters, and there was no way through. Some perished in the treacherous mudflats. Others tried to swim the Hass itself and were lost by the hundreds. Most cowered in the stinking slime under the dock wall, wailing plaintively up at the soldiers 200 metres above them on the wall top, men who could do nothing to help them. Almost 2,000 people remained penned in that filthy corner of the wall through the first days of the conflict, too afraid to try the route back round the wall to Hass Gate. Starvation, disease, and despair killed them all within 4 days. The Sondar Gate was open, and the main tide of refugees sought entry there. The Vervan primary troops, focused en masse to control the crowd, admitted the people as quickly as possible, but it was miserably slow going, and the column of people stretched 3 kilometres back into the burning outer Habs. Many of the tail-enders, certain they would be dead before ever reaching the safety of the hive's shield, turned around and headed out into the salt grasslands by the hundreds. None were ever seen alive again. In the square of marshals, just inside the Hieronymo Sondar Gate, the hive troopers struggled to manage the overwhelming influx of citizens. 40% of the arrivals were injured. Captain Letro Cargin had been given charge of the operation, and inside an hour he was close to despair. He had first tried to contain the refugees in the vast ceremonial square itself, but it quickly became filled to overflowing. Some family groups were climbing the pedestals of the statues around the square to find somewhere to crouch. There was group singing, work anthems of the hive or imperial hymns. The massed, frail voices, set against the constant thunder of the bombardment and the crackle of the shield above, unnerved his men. The Vervan primary barracks northwest of the square, which had taken hits in the first stage of the attack, was still blazing but under control. Cargin voxed house command repeatedly until he was granted special permission for the guilds to open the Anko chemical plant west of the square and the guild manufacturers to the east to house the overspill. Quickly, these new areas became overfilled too. The guilds had issued particular instructions as to how much of those areas could be used or even entered. Cargin's men reported fights breaking out as they tried to deny access to certain areas. Shots were fired over the heads of the crowd. Compared to the onslaught they had weathered outside, the small arms of the troops were insignificant, and the house guard found themselves pushed back deeper into the industrial areas, trying to accommodate the intake. Most troopers were profoundly unwilling to shoot at their own citizens. In one instance, an angry junior officer actually fired into the encroaching crowd, killing 2. He and his 6-man squad were torn apart by a pack of smoke-blackened textile workers. Cargin voxed frantically for supplies and advice. By 8 in the evening, new orders were being issued from House Command and the legislature, designating refugee assembly areas, hastily arranged in the inner worker habs south of the pylon and the Commercia. Asylum traffic from the Sondar Gate, Hass Gate, and, to a lesser extent, the Crow Gate, was now choking the southern sectors of the hive. Some of the House legislature, meeting in extraordinary session in the main spine, argued that it was the hive's duty to house the outer hab population. Others were simply afraid that with the main southern arterials choked, they would never be able to mobilize their armies. Six noble houses also volunteered aid, which began to be shipped by carriage route down to the Square of Marshals and the main city landing field, where the refugees from Hass Gate were also congregating. It was a start, but not enough. Cargin began to wonder if the upper echelon of the Hive really understood the scale of the problem. The imperial mottos, Hive slogans, and other messages of calming propaganda flashing up on the public address plates did little to deaden the general panic. Cargin had angry, frightened citizens by the thousands, most stone-deaf from concussion shock, many burned naked by the blasts, many more dying and stretcher-bound. Short of closing the gate itself, he had no way to stem the flow. His 3,000 men were vastly outnumbered by the mass. Cargin was voxed to the north corner of the square. There he found a field station had been set up by medics from some inner Hab infirmary. Hundreds of the injured had been laid out on the stone paving. Doctors and orderlies dressed in crimson gowns and masks tended to them.
"Are you Cargin?"
Cargin looked round. A gowned and masked figure was addressing him. She pulled off her mask to reveal an appealing, heart-shaped face. The eyes, though, were hard and bewildered.
"Yes, doctor?"
"Surgeon Anna Karth, Inner Hab Collective Medical Hall, 67 MV. I've been given authority here. We are trying to set up a triage station under the carriage stands over there, but the flow is too great."
"I'm doing my best, surgeon," he said flatly.
He could see tractor units and trucks lining the barrack road, headlamps blazing and engines gunning, moving in to transport those in need of immediate surgery to the main infirmary facilities in the inner Habs and low spine.
"Likewise," said Kurth, without humour.
The air smelled of blood and burned flesh and was full of piteous shrieking.
"The medical halls are already full of wounded from the inner city. There were huge casualties from the start of the raid, before the shield was ignited."
"I don't know what to say," Cargin shrugged. "I followed my orders and allowed the incoming to flow out of the square into adjacent areas. There seems to be no end to them. My observers on the wall top say the queue outside is still 3 kilometers long."
The surgeon looked at the blood-spattered paving for a moment, her hands on her hips.
"I..."
she began, then paused.
"Can you get me a vox link? I'll try sending to my superiors. The commissia has been evacuated and there is vast floor space inside it. I doubt they'll grant permission, but I'll do what I can."
Cargin nodded. He called his vox officer over and told him to attend the surgeon.
"Whatever you can do is better than nothing," he told her.
The tank roared and bounced over the trampled grass hillocks. Heading north at full throttle, its turret reversed to spit shells into the firefields behind it, into the invisible enemy at its heels. The night sky was ablaze. Scorching trails of rockets and shrieking shells tore overhead, heading for the Hive. Commissar Cowell crouched in the turret of the running tank, shouting orders to fire to the gun crew in the lit space below him. The Voxlink was down. He couldn't reach House Command. He had 42 tanks left out of the armored column of more than 450 that had left the Sondar Gate that afternoon. No ranking Vervan primary armor officer was left alive. Cadet Fosker was also dead. Cowell had command now. Using the VPHC Commissar Langana as his second officer, he had managed to regroup the shattered remnants of the tank force and swing it back towards the city. It felt like retreat, but Cowell knew it was a sound tactical decision. They were facing an ochre wave out there on the grass flats, a stupendous Zoika armored front pushing in through 3 salients. Only in his days with the Imperial Guard, during major offensives like Balhaut and Kosiaminus, had he seen anything like this scale of assault. And there were infantry regiments behind, thick like locusts, following the armor. Cowell didn't even want to think about the size of the opposition just now. It was unbelievable. It was impossible. An ochre wave. That's all he could see, the tide of ochre-painted machines rolling over his forces, crushing them. He tried the vox again, but the enemy was jamming all bands. Shells rained down amongst the retreating Vervan tanks. At least 2 blew out as munitions ignited, sending tank hulls end over end in fireballs, spraying track segments out like shattered teeth. The driver was calling him over the intercom.
Ahead, sir.
Cal swiveled round. Vervenhive was in sight now, the great luminous blister of green energy flickering on the skyline like a giant mushroom cloud, glowing in the dark. Cal grabbed his scope and saw the blackened, burning mass of the outer Habs fast approaching. A persistent rain of explosives was still dropping into them.
"Cal to column," he spat into his inter-tank vox. "Form up and follow me in down the southern highway. We will re-enter the city through the Sondar Gate. Let none shirk, for I will find them wanting, and find them."
He smiled at his last words. Even now, under a storm of fire, he could still turn a good disciplinarian phrase. The high-ceilinged, gilt-ornamented Hall of the Legislature, high and secure in the upper sections of the main spire, was full of arguing voices. Lord Heimlich Chass, noble patriarch of House Chass, sat back in his velvet-upholstered bench and glanced aside to his aides and chamberlains. The legislature was full tonight. All 9 noble houses were in attendance, as well as the representatives of the other 21 houses ordinary, along with the drones of over 300 guild associations and families in their flamboyant finery. And down in the Commons pit, hundreds of Habitat and Workclave representatives bayed for action. As a scion of a noble house, Chass's bench was in the inner circle, just above the legislator's dais. Vox picked drones mumbled and hovered along the benches like bumblebees. The legislator choir, told to shut up some minutes before by Noble Crow, sat sullenly in their balcony, bawling up pages of sheet music and throwing them down on the assembly beneath. Master Jennick of House Ordinary Jennick was on his feet in the middle circle, reading from a prepared slate and trying to get someone to listen to his 55-point plan. Chass pressed the Jenner reader on the side of his hardwood stool, and the plate slid open before him. He keyed in his authority rating, touched the statement runes, and wrote, "Master Legislator, are we going to debate or simply argue all night?" The words flashed up on the central plate, and 6 other noble houses, 15 houses ordinary, and the majority of the guild associations assented. Silence fell. The master legislator, Anofi, an ancient hunchback with a tricorn ribboned hat, crawled to his feet from his dais throne and began the litany of enfranchisement. The assembly was quiet as it was intoned. Anofi stroked his long silver moustache, smoothed the front of his opalescent robe, and asked the assembly for points of order. Around 70 holographic runes lit the plate display and glowed overhead via hovering repeater screens.
"Noble Anko has the floor."
There were moans from the commons pit. Anko got up, or rather was helped up by his entourage. His raspy, vox-amplified voice rang around the hall.
"I deplore the attack on our city hive by our erstwhile friends of Zoika. I press to vote. We deny them and send them home, tails between their legs."
No argument there, thought Chass. Typical Anko, going for the easy vote. Anko went on.
"I wish the legislature to back me on another matter. My plant is being overrun by indigents from the suburbs. House officers tell me that the plant is already overwhelmed and immediate production will be impossible. This hurts Vervenhive. I move that House Anko be allowed to eject the indigents from its premises."
More squabbling and yelling from below.
"Noble Yetch, are we to disabuse our work population so, Cousin Anko? You like them well enough when they raise your quotas. Do you hate them now that they choke your factories?"
Commotion. Louder than before. Several nobles and many guilders thumped their assent sirens vigorously. Anko sat down, his expression vile.
"Noble Chass."
Chass rose.
"I fear my cousin Anko fails to read the larger story here. 90 years have passed since we faced such a crisis. We face a second trade war. Reports are that the wave of enemy force is quite humbling to our own defenses.
We have all seen how the tumult today has wounded our hive. Why, my own dear daughter barely reached home alive.
Sympathetic holograms flashed sycophantically from the tears of some of the house's ordinary. Chas continued,
If this attack inconveniences our houses, I say, let us be inconvenienced. We have a duty to the hive population, and Cousin Anko should put that bald fact before his production quota. I wish to frame more important questions to this legislature. 1. Why did this attack come as a surprise? 2. Should we signal the Imperium for assistance? 3. Where is the High Master? What did he know of this, and why was the shield ignited so late?
Now the roaring grew. Ascent sigils lit up all around. The legislator screamed for order.
Noble Chas, a voice said,
lilting through the huge hall.
How would you wish me to answer that?
The place fell silent. Escorted by 10 impassive, uniformed officers of the VPHC, High Master Salvador Sondar entered the hall. He was blind in one eye and limping badly. His flesh was blistered and charred, and his clothes were tattered, but he was still plant supervisor. Using an axe rake as a crutch, Organ Sorik bellowed as best his crisped lungs could manage as he brought over 300 smeltery workers out through the northern processing ramps of Vervin Smeltery 1. Most were as soot black as he was, the only thing showing against the grime being the glistening red of wounds or the white of fresh dressings. That and the workers' white, fear-filled eyes. They carried their injured with them, some on makeshift stretchers, some in carriers made of tied sacking, some pushed in ore barrows. Sorik stomped around and looked back with his one good eye. Vervin Smeltery 1 and parts of the surrounding ore plants were burning furiously. Chimney stacks collapsed in the heat, sending up white cinders against the yellow flames. The Vevere rail terminal to the west was also torching out. He heard shouting and disputes from the concourse below him, and he hobbled down, pushing his way through the rows of men and women from his plant. A dozen Vervin primary soldiers were stopping the survivors' advance down transit channel 456K into the inner Habs. A VPHC officer was leading them.
We need to get in there,
Sorik said, stomping up to the commissariat officer. Even with one eye, Sorik could see the twitchy, frantic light in the young VPHC's eyes.
Orders from main spine, old man, the commissar told him. Lohab is choked with refugees. No more may be admitted. You camp here. Supplies will come in time.
What's your name?
Sorik asked.
Commissar Baunom.
Sorik paused, leaned awkwardly on his crutch, and wiped the ash from his supervisor's badge with a hawk of spit. He held it up so the uniformed man could see.
Sorik, plant supervisor, Smeltery 1. We've just been bombed to Gak, and my workers need access to cover and treatment. Now, not in time.
There is no way through. Access is denied. Make your people comfortable here.
The troopers behind Baunom raised their weapons as punctuation.
Here? In a stinking street, with the works burning behind us? I don't think so. Boy, Smeltery 1 is the property of Noble House Gavunda. We are all Lord Gavunda's souls. If he hears of this...
I answer only to House Sondar, as should you. Don't threaten me.
Where's the gacking threat, you idiot?
Sorik asked, looking round at his massing workers and getting a spirited laugh in answer.
A one-eyed cripple like me? Let us through. Aye, let us through,
bellowed a worker beside Sorik. Osmak, probably, but it was impossible to tell under the soot. Other workers jeered and agreed.
Do you understand what a state of emergency is, old man?
Baunom asked.
Understand? I'm gecking leaving it,
Sorik blurted.
Stand aside.
He tried to push past the VPHC officer, but Baunom pushed back, and Sorik fell off his crutch onto the debris-littered paving. There were shouts of disbelief and anger. Workers surged forward. Baunom backed away, pulled out his auto-pistol, and fired into the approaching mass. Osmak fell dead, and another collapsed wounded.
That's it! Enough! Be warned! Yelled the commissar. You will all stay where—
Sarek's axe rake crutch shattered Baunom's skull and felled him to the ground. Before any of the troopers could react, the workers were on them like a tidal wave. All of the troopers were killed in a few seconds. The smeltery workers gathered up their weapons. Worker Ganif handed the commissar's pistol to Sarek.
I'll see you right,
Sarek barked. He waved for them to follow him down the transit channel. They cheered him and moved on, at his heels, into the city.
Marshal Knight is dead,
High Master Sundar told the legislature. The hall had remained silent as the High Master's floating throne ascended to the main dais with its stone-faced VPHC vanguard. Sundar's throne had locked into place above the High Legislator's dais, and the Master of Vervenhive had spent a long moment looking out at the assembly before speaking. He was dressed in regal robes, his face masked with a turquoise ceramic Janus.
Dead,
Sundar repeated.
Our High faces a time of war. And you, noble houses, low houses, guilders, you decide it is time to usurp my position?
Silence remained. Sundar's masked visage turned to look around at the vast swoop of the tiered hall.
We are one, or we are nothing.
Still, the nervous silence.
I believe you think me weak. I am not weak. I believe you think me stupid. I am not that either. I believe that certain high houses see this as an opportunity to further their own destinies.
The High Master allowed noble Anko to rise with a wave of his hand.
We never doubted you, High Lord. The trade war fell upon us so suddenly.
You witless weakling, Chas thought. Sundar has led us to this blind, and you reconcile sweetly. Where is the fervor that had us vote to take executive action this afternoon?
Zoika will be denied,
Sundar said. Chas watched the High Lord's movements and saw how jerky they were. It's not him, he thought. The wretch has sent another servitor puppet to represent him.
We have sent word to the Northern Foundry Collectives and to Vanik Magna. They will bolster us with garrison troops. Our counterattack will begin in 2 days.
There was delighted commotion from the Commons Pit and the Guild tiers. Chas rose and spoke.
I believe it is in the interests of Vergast as a whole to send to the Imperium for assistance.
No,
responded Sundar quickly.
We have beaten Zoika before. We will do it again. This is an internal matter.
No longer,
a voice said from below. The assembly looked down at the benches where the officials of the administratum sat. Hooded and gowned, Intendant Bainfail of the Imperial Administratum got to his feet.
Astropathic messages have already been sent out, imploring Imperial assistance from Warmaster Makaroth. Vervenhive's production of ordnance and military vehicles is vital for the constant supply of the Sabbat World's Crusade. The Warmaster will take our plight seriously. This is a greater matter than local planetary politics, High Lord Sundar.
Sundar, or rather the being that represented him, seemed to quiver in his throne. Rage, Chas presumed. The balance between Hive and Imperial authority had always been delicate in Vervenhive, indeed in all the nobilities of Vergast. It was rare for it to clash so profoundly and so visibly. Chas well knew the fundamental strategic import of Vervenhive and the other Vergast manufactory cities to the Crusade, but still the magnitude of the Intendant's actions amazed him. The Administratum was the bureaucratic right hand of the Emperor himself, but it usually bowed to the will of the local planetary governor. Our plight must truly be serious, he realized, a sick feeling seeping into his heart. Holding the infant and pulling the small boy by the hand, Tona Creed ran through the burning northern section of the Commercia. The boy was crying now. She couldn't help that. If they could make the docks, she could get them clear across the river and to safety. but the routes were packed. As fast as refugees came into the hive from the south, inhabitants were fleeing to the north.
"Where are we going?"
asked the boy, Dalin.
"Somewhere safe,"
Tona told him.
"Who are you?"
"I'm your aunt Tona."
"I don't have an aunt."
"You do now, and so does Yancy here."
"Yancy?"
"Yeah, whatever. Come on."
Tona tried to thread them through the massing crowds that filled the transit channels down to the docks, but they were jammed tight.
"Where are we going?"
asked the kid again, as they sheltered in a barter house awning to avoid the press.
"Away, to the river."
That was the plan. But with the crowds this thick, she didn't know if it was going to be possible. Maybe they'd be safer in the city, under the shield. The baby began to cry. He couldn't breathe. The weight and blackness upon him were colossal. Something oily was dripping into his eyes. He tried to move, but no movement was possible. No, that wasn't true. He could grind his toes in his army boots. His mouth was full of rockcrete dust. He started to cough and found his lungs had no room to move. He was squashed. There was a rattling, chinking sound above him. He could hear voices, distant and muffled. He tried to cry out, but the dust choked him, and he had no room to choke. Light, a chink of light, just above as rubble was moved away. Rubble moved, and some pieces slumped heavier on him, vicing his legs and pelvis. There was a face in the gap above him.
"Who's down there?" it called. "Are you alive?"
Hoarse and dry, he answered.
"My name is Bandaur, and yes, I am alive."
His family house was deserted. Gilda Warlin strode inside, leaving a sticky tread of blood in his footprints. His clan was at the legislature, he was sure. Let them go and bow and scrape to the High Lord. He crossed the draped room to the teak trolley by the ornamental window and poured himself a triple shot of Jalik. Menx and Truer waited in the anteroom, whispering nervously.
"Bodyguard, to me!"
Warlin called as the fire of the drink warmed his body. He waved an actuator wand at the wall plate and saw nothing but cycling scrolls of Imperium propaganda. He snapped the plate off and dropped the wand. His bodyguard approached. They had both shrouded their weapons again, as was the custom inside guild households. Warlin sat back on the suspenser couch and sipped his drink, smiling. Outside the window, the sprawl of Vervinhive spread out, many parts of it ablaze. The green, shield-tinted sky contorted with the constant shelling.
"You have served me well tonight," Warlin told them.
The bodyguards paused, uncertain.
"Manx, Truer, my friends, fetch yourselves a drink from the cart and relax. Your master is proud of you."
They hesitated, and then turned. Truer raised a decanter as Manx found glasses. As soon as they had their backs to him, Warlin pulled the needle pistol from his robes and fired. The first shot blew Menx's spine out, and he was flung face first into the cart, which broke under him and shattered. Truer turned, and the decanter in his hand was shattered by the second shot. The third exploded his face, and he dropped backwards onto the cart wreckage. Warlin got up and, drink in hand, fired 30 more needles into the twisted corpses, just to be sure. Then he sat back, sipping his drink, watching Vervinhive burn.
"The road is blocked, sir,"
the tank driver yelled through the intercom to Cowl. Chasing up the southern highway through the wrecked outer habs, with shells still falling, Cowl's column had reached the rear of the queue of refugees tailing back from Sondar Gate. Cowl sat up in the turret, looking ahead, taking in the sea of milling bodies before them. Shells fell to the west and lit up the night. Cowl dropped into the turret and said, "Drive through." The driver looked back at him in amazement.
"But, Commissar..."
"Are you denying a direct order?"
Cowl snapped.
"No, sir, Commissar, sir, but..."
Cowl shot him through the throat and dragged his twitching body out of the driver's seat. He settled into the blood-slick metal chair and keyed the intercom.
"Armor column, follow me."
Just out-hab wretches. Worthless, he decided, as he drove the tank down through the masses, crushing a path to the distant gates of Vervinhive.